So next up is Simon Blackburn, who's the Bertrand Russell Professor of Philosophy at the University of Cambridge, one of the organizers of the workshop that we've been having. He also goes to University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill for part of the year, and has written a series of wonderful books, which I've made many of my plane journeys much more interesting. One of the more recent ones is How to Read Hume. He did a Plato's Republic, and also some very clever one-liners, which think, being good, lust, and truth. Simon Blackburn.
Thank you very much. Yes, I was very, very, very pleased to be able to write a book called Lust between a book called Being Good and another one called Truth, because that's not where lust usually comes. Yes, well, you've heard some wonderfully inspirational speeches, and I feel very inadequate following on because I am not really an inspirational speaker, and I don't really wish to preach to you. Of course, much of what has been said I agree with. I agree with Lawrence that it's not a very good idea to go around with your eyes shut or to let your fantasies determine what you think the world is like, as opposed to empirical investigation. I think we can all put our hands up to that. I agree with Peter Singer that we could be more charitable, and I believe that charity is a virtue, and I think we probably should be more charitable. Although I also agree with Pat Churchland that charity is very easily misdirected, and in some cases, such as massive aid charity to Africa, there's a nasty fear that it can do more harm than good, and often does. So it's got to be tempered by an intelligent awareness of the consequences. So all these things I thoroughly agree with. I also agree, of course, that our values can be tempered by science. I think, for example, that our further understanding, for example, of the similarities between the male brain and the female brain will get march alongside other cultural causes to assist in the equality of women, and I hope it very much does so. I think measurements of identity of intelligence, identity of skill, identity of other cognitive functions, that would be a scientific measurement, and it could also insist, for example, in breaking down racial barriers and in breaking down gender barriers. So, of course, science can inform our values and should inform our values, and I think we all put our hands up to that. As to whether you need nothing but science, which I think was the message, the first message we heard, I think, I'm afraid, I don't agree with Sam about that, and neither do the other three speakers I think we've heard so far. And the reason I think is an important reason, it's a philosophical reason, I'll just spend a couple of minutes saying why I think it's so. It seems to me that values, let's start one step further back. Virtually all philosophies of mind recognize two different kinds of mental state. There are mental states whose business is to reflect the world as it is, to represent the world, to, in other words, inform you, for example, about the environment in which you are to act. And those go by the name of beliefs. If a belief is sufficiently certain and sufficiently well tested, you might call it knowledge. So there are beliefs about the world, knowledge about the world, and their business is to reflect the world as it is. But then there are mental states like desires or intentions or concerns. Now, they have a slightly different than the usual metaphor that philosophers use is directions of fit. They're the things you care about. And their function is to motivate you to get the world to conform to the content of the desire. If you desire to go to the beer and get a fridge, you want to change, to go to the fridge and get a beer. yes, a Freudian slip, I think. if you desire to go to the fridge and get a beer, your business is that you're set, you're poised, you're disposed to change the world so that, first of all, you become nearer to the fridge than you were, and secondly, you get a beer. that's changing the world. And the function of the desire is to change the world to conform to whatever is the content of the desire. Now, many, many moral philosophers, myself included, put values on the desire side of those mental states. The job of values is to orientate you towards the world, to orientate the way you behave, to, as it were, reflect what you care about and what you desire. It's not just what you desire, it's what you are concerned about in much more important ways. A value is like a desire that you're prepared to make public, that you want coordination on, that you're prepared to insist upon from other people. At its limit, it'll define things that you think you must do, not just things you want to do, and things that other people must do in their relationship to you. So those are values. So it's going to be inevitable that there's a gap between fact and value, because the two mental states, the ones that represent the way of the world and the ones that motivate you to act in the world as you understand it to be, have this different function. So it's one thing to know the world and what the world is like. It's another thing to care about it in any particular way. Now, Sam said that you could just chuck away all the writings of moral philosophers because science had discovered that ethics is about promoting welfare and avoiding suffering. Well, I don't know which science discovered that. It was certainly a major theme of Aristotle. It was a major theme of the Buddha. It's a major theme of Christianity. It's a major theme, as far as I'm aware, of every moral philosopher that's ever lived. Where the moral philosophers find the going difficult is in having an adequate conception of human flourishing. So let me give an example, a couple of examples. Some people think that flourishing is just a matter of contented, happy, kind of dreamlike mental states, a bit like after you've taken a spliff or two, or you've got that beer out of the fridge. And another one. This was the target of, for example, Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. He wrote about a world of sort of zombies, happy zombies kept in a kind of dreamlike contented state by a combination of drugs and lies. Another way you can be happy, you can flourish, is by living in a fool's paradise, by turning your face away from the things that might make you unhappy, or just being ignorant of them. So you could take two people in identical apparent mental states. Each of them believes they're living the American dream, but one of them is in complete illusion. He believes that his wife loves him, his children love him, his job is going well, his colleagues respect him. None of that's true. He's living in a fool's paradise. And according to Aristotle and many moral philosophers following him, that man is not flourishing. Because he's living under an illusion, he is, however happy he may say he is, and however happy he might appear to be by some neurological measure, since it is not a life of achievement and of real truth and attainment to a way of being in the actual world, he is living in a fool's paradise. Again, other people have had conceptions of flourishing which included suppressing desires rather than satisfying them. The Buddha did this. Stoicism does this. The idea is that you can easily become a kind of utility gobbler, a utility monster. You want to gobble up experiences. You want to gobble up goods. You want to buy bigger houses. You want to satisfy more and more and more desires. And that isn't a flourishing way of life, even if you manage to satisfy them. The real life consists in self-mastery and wisdom and understanding that a desire satisfaction doesn't necessarily bring the most flourishing kind of life. Now, all those are moral ideas which throw around the conception of well-being and problematize it. Sam thinks we can do without all that, that you can go to a scientist and say, was Buddha right about flourishing? I don't think you can. I think you have to work out for yourself what you care about in your life and the way you care to live it. And actually the same comes when it's a question of the utility of others. Peter talks about the expanding circle as if reason by itself means that you, as it were, expand from being concerned just for yourself and for your family to being concerned for more and more and more sentient things until eventually you become a servant of the world, giving away all your money to other people and so forth. I don't think reason tells you any such thing. I think it's an excellent thing if you expand your sentiments, and I very much hope, as it were, that we all do become more charitable. But I don't think you're under any obligation to become a servant of the world. And one of the hardest things in ethics is to decide how to prioritize your own well-being and the well-being of your family, well-being of those who, to whom you owe debts of gratitude, your loyalty to particular groups who, with, amongst whom you live, versus a more impersonal duty to those who lie outside that immediate circle. I think prioritizing one over the other is a very hard decision many of us have to make, all of us have to make. Every time you take your children on holiday, you could be saving three children in Africa, you know, their death or their eyesight or whatever. And yet people do go on taking their children on holiday. And I'm glad they do. I think they have to. So prioritizing these things is very hard. It's very difficult. It's not solved just by saying, oh, it would be awful if everybody was miserable and be wonderful if everyone was happy. You can't live simply with that as a guide. It's no guide at all. So I'm afraid ethics is and remains a very difficult subject, and it's a complete illusion to suppose that science will give us all the answers. Thank you very much.